GeekSpeak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
It is Saturday, October 16th, 2010, on the Central Coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, geek news, your questions and comments on technology. It is time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Miles Elam. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz. In the air room with me are Al Luckow, New Media Architect.
Hello, everybody.
And Lindsay Lonnie, System Analyst.
Good morning.
So, with that underwhelming music that appeared to be in mono.
Glorious mono.
Which apparently is better than I usually do.
Throwback, no mono.
I'm stepping up. Now, instead of no channels, I have one channel.
Woohoo.
So, let's start off with some news. Lindsay Lonnie.
I just wanted to do an update of something that we talked about last week. So, this young man in San Jose found that the FBI had put a tracking device onto his car. And there's been a couple of updates where it's just more details about the story, basically. They had demanded it back. And as of the last time we talked, he hadn't decided if he was going to give it back or what he was going to do with it. On Reddit, they were talking about shipping it around all over the world.
Sorry, on Reddit. What is Reddit?
It's a blog, news. I don't know, maybe you know more about it than I do.
A news aggregator. Right.
Right. Exactly. So they were talking about shipping it all over the world so that the FBI would wonder where it was, you know, Europe, Japan, different places like that. But he did end up giving it back to them. And in doing so, Schneier, who's a security expert, started talking about this on his blog and the implications of it. The consensus is they don't think that the Supreme Court is going to allow it to continue after they review it, but we'll see what actually happens. There's no way to know for sure yet. But basically,
yeah, unfortunately, with all the legal dilemma associated with that or the risk associated with that, I really would have been curious. It would have been like to say, no, we're not going to give it back to you.
Right.
What are you talking about? You gave it to me.
Yeah.
It's on my car.
And you know, maybe one of us might have, but you know, this
yeah,
is a
you
20-
intentionally put it there. It wasn't like it was
really.
Yeah, it wasn't just like it's lost and there's a lost and found.
It would have been funny to ship it all over the world, though.
Yes, it would.
Like the North Pole or something, you know, or Murdo.
Well, not many mailboxes station off in the North Pole, but yeah.
You could ship to McMurdo Station at South Pole.
Right, but like showing up in Amsterdam and you have like a little photo and then, you know, then a Kinshasa. It's like, here you go.
You know what would freak them out.
And apparently they found it because they were doing some work on the car and the unit was an old GPS unit that had a huge battery pack the size of a mag light. And they were like, what is this thing? But this guy's like 20 years old. He's here. He's half Egyptian. And his father was a leader of a Muslim organization. His father was a U.S. citizen, but moved back to Egypt. And the only thing that he really did was guilty by association. A friend of his posted on Reddit about his opinions about terrorism and got on the FBI watch list. And just because he's a friend of this other guy, he ended up getting tracked. But, yeah, interesting implications. It's funny, though, the guy that posted on Reddit about the terrorism thing, at the end of his post, he said, oh, I'm bugged for sure now. Little did he know, not only is he bugged, but his friends.
Thank you for that story.
Sure.
Mr. Al Luckow.
Yes. Oh, me, yeah. Hey, there's something that's kind of interesting right now. This is pretty cool. It's apparently, you know what a tractor beam is?
Yes, I've watched Star Trek,
yes.
So I think I know what a tractor beam is.
There's probably nobody in our entire listening audience that doesn't know what a tractor beam is, but they also know that tractor beams are science fiction. Well, apparently not. There's a group that has created an actual tractor beam. It's at the Australian National University, And what they did was they took these lasers and they shot the laser in sort of like a tube, like a pipe. So the laser part, the hot laser part was around the circle, and then the center of the laser had no light at all. It wasn't hot at all. And so what they did was they shot this beam at some tiny glass particles, and the air surrounding the glass particles heats up, okay, and it kind of forces the glass particles into the center of this laser beam.
Okay.
And then when they move the laser beam, the heat from the outer part of the laser beam, the bright part, it forces the molecules back there, and they bounce off and they go back into the center where it's cool. So they're able to basically take this laser beam, point it at these glass particles, and sort of get it in that little pipe and just move them around and just kind of pull them in or move them back and forth and move them around. So that is a tractor beam.
Well, it seems like going into side to side, that makes more sense to me. But how would they pull toward or away from the beam?
It doesn't say exactly how they do it.
You'd need another beam,
probably. I think they need the lithium crystals. But that's only my speculation. But it's kind of neat, though, that, I mean, it's, you know, obviously you're not going to be lifting people's cars up with this anytime soon.
Not yet.
But it's a start.
Not that we know of.
Yeah. Hey, what happened to my glass particles?
Yeah, that actually reminds me. I always wondered, and I'm wondering if someone out there is a total Star Trek nerd and can answer this for us. What's the deal with a dilithium crystal? Like, what's so special about lithium or having a, you know, a two-molecule version of lithium that has so much energy that can harness an antimatter, a matter-antimatter reaction?
You've got to have more power, Captain!
Yeah, of course, this is just a TV show, so yes. I guess I should just move.
I'm a doctor, not an engineer.
Yeah, why, Miles, why?
Yeah.
So I will do just a very quick story, which is the Denver airport is being overrun by car-eating rabbits. Okay, on to the next story. Oh, just kidding.
Do tell.
As it happens, most cars built after 2002 have their electrical wires covered in a soy-based insulator rather than a synthetic material. Yes, and the rodents find it very tasty. And, you know, word got out, and suddenly it's a wire soy fest, or soy wire fest. And so many people at the Denver Airport parking lot, known as the Pikes Peak lot, have found their cars after coming home from a long trip to be slightly less than what they found them.
Oh my gosh. Hmm.
Very sad story.
So I wonder what the liability is if you park your car in a parking lot and rabbits come in and eat parts of it.
I mean, I'm sure the airport is going to say force majeure.
Yeah. So, there's all that stuff they give you in that little ticket that says, you know, what happens to your car is not our fault, blah, blah,
if
blah.
If rabbits eat your car, then it's not our fault. And you have to agree to
it's
this.
It's an act of
rabbits eat my car. Like, that's going to happen.
It's an act of nature. Like a hailstorm.
That in a lot of those long-term parking places have a thing that says, you know, don't leave valuables in your car. We're not responsible for those things. But, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's unfortunate.
Yeah. To say the least. So, Lindsay.
Yes.
Tell us something that isn't quite as unfortunate.
Okay. I will tell you about, how about the Google funding power backbone for a major wind farm. So, on the 11th, Google said that it's giving 30% of the development stage funding for a project called the Atlantic Wind Connection. And it's an effort by an independent company called the TransElect to create a 350-mile power transmission backbone linking wind turbines several miles offshore of the East Coast. And it's just the backbone that they're working on right now. It's estimated that this power backbone would have the capacity to deliver enough power for 1.9 million households. TransElect said that it's hoping to start construction in 2013 with the first connection arriving in 2016. The project wouldn't be finished until 2021. And that includes, you know, the wind farms and all that good stuff. But yeah, about 15 miles off the coast, a bunch of wind farms, and then Google supporting this backbone.
On the East Coast, and probably nowhere near Cape Cod, because they
right.
shot down those wind farms so many times before.
What does Google have to do with all this, though? I mean, are they...
They're basically just helping, providing funding. Apparently, they have a big interest in clean power, and, you know, I don't know.
I would think they have an interest in finding out how people use power or using how they can put ads in your power or something like that. That's where their interest is.
They're interested in everything.
We just don't know what Google's up to.
Well, that actually reminds me. I'm just going to do a quick little side note. There's a comic strip known as XKCD.
Fantastic.
And yes, it's a wonderful humor. And one of the humor bits in a recent cartoon came out a couple months ago, I guess, was talking about password entropy.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about, you know, password entropy is when you want to make a password harder to choose. So when you're filling in that password on that new site and it says, oh, that password's too weak, that means that there's not enough entropy, there's not enough randomness to it. You're just putting in a dictionary word or something easily guessed.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes on to talk about, I won't spoil the whole joke, but it does go on to talk about Google and them talking about, do you know evil, even though they have all this information about us. And they, so
that was a good,
but they had that mantra of, do you know evil?
Right.
And at the same time, it's like, but now they have all this information. So now they can turn evil, right? Like, so everyone, we control the world's information. Now it's time to turn evil. What's the plan? We make boatloads of money. We already do that.
Yeah.
We set up a company-wide gaming server and do a tournament every week. That's not evil. Oh, dibs in the lobby TV. It's like puppet masters who want nothing from their puppets, you know?
Yeah. Hopefully Google will stay that way.
Hopefully Google will stay that way and just fund our wind power transition into the 21st century or the further into the 21st century.
Just because they love their loyal subjects.
Sorry for that interruption. I guess I took cuts in front of Al.
But, oh, what do you want to know about today? Boy, there's so much to talk about.
Well, let's hear about class warfare.
Class warfare. Which would that would so many stories.
You have about a certain CEO.
Oh, yeah. Well, Yahoo is back in the news. Apparently, Yahoo's CEO, Carol Bartz, is on the list of the 25 most overpaid CEOs.
Not best paid, but overpaid?
Yeah, they say overpaid. And this is from Fortune. Fortune has determined this somehow. They figured out how much a CEO could make. But she makes $39 million a year.
Wow.
And, you know, I don't know what she...
Yahoo's
she's the one,
been in pretty dire straits.
Well,
late,
she's
so.
She just she's the one that replaced Jerry Yang, who was, you know, the founder. So maybe that means that the person after the founder makes a lot of money or something. But that's what they said. She's on that list. And there's just, you know, when I guess they take into consideration how the company's doing, which is, you know, I mean, in this kind of economic climate, you hear somebody making $39 million. I mean, $38 million, sure, but $39 million?
Yeah.
One interesting thing, though, about Yahoo, and this is something I just noticed, is that the Yahoo application, the Yahoo Messenger, has just been released for the iPhone. And that means that you can install Yahoo Messenger. It's free on your phone. And, you know, if you have a Yahoo Messenger account, which is also free, most people have them, at least left over from the 90s, you go, oh, your old account, open it up again. You can actually message people from your phone, either text or video. And this works over your regular 3G network, which FaceTime does not. So that means you could be using your iPhone and you can call somebody from your computer and call somebody on an iPhone, or an iPhone call somebody on a computer, or an iPhone can call another iPhone, and you can talk to somebody using video.
Wonderful.
Which is amazing, actually. They say it works on the iPhone 4, 3G, and it also works over Wi-Fi video calling. I tried it this morning with my wife, and it worked, you know, but it almost sort of reminds me of the old choppy Yahoo video that we know and love. It doesn't have the clarity of FaceTime, but the weird thing is...
Were you both on Wi-Fi, though?
Actually, I kind of got out of the Wi-Fi area so I could test it over 3G.
Okay, so that's apples and oranges because FaceTime only works on Wi-Fi.
Right, because FaceTime, you need to be in a Wi-Fi area, and a lot of times you are, and the video is perfect, and it's really great and all that. But, you know, how would it be if you were, like, you know, at a store or, you know, sitting in a parking lot or something? Could you video chat with somebody? And that's what this
is one of the concerns with regard to FaceTime was the fact that 3G was going to take up too much bandwidth, and AT&T didn't want that.
Right. And, you know, it's just a matter of time before they allow FaceTime to go over 3G. And, you know, time will tell how that ends up being. But it's funny to see that Apple actually let Yahoo develop this. And, you know, it does use, you know, the data network to do it. Maybe there's some cap on it or something. I don't know. But it is kind of neat to think about, you know, just being anywhere you want. And just it's one more little step closer to that Dick Tracy watch.
Cool. And speaking of things that are very cool, Jeremy from Santa Cruz, a regular listener, he's a little reluctant to come on air. And I understand that. It's a little daunting. But he came up with our answer to the dilithium crystal question.
Oh, excellent.
He was a sufficiently adept nerd, and we applaud him and bow to his power. Yes. Dilithium crystals are the only thing porous to antimatter.
Oh, that's what
which means you could the only thing that you could actually use is the storage mechanism for it.
It's a sponge for antimatter.
Yeah. Mm. So thank you very much, Jeremy. That was awesome.
Yes. We bow to your nerditude.
You are alpha nerd for the day. Lindsay.
Okay. This is kind of unrelated to the things we've talked about so far, but there's an election coming up, so I figured it was valid here.
There is? When is that election?
That would be on November 2nd.
Oh, and what's the last day to register to vote?
That would be the 18th, I believe.
The 18th. Remember that, folks. Last day to vote. Last day to register to vote.
Yes, the 18th.
The 18th of this month, Monday.
Yes.
Okay.
So register. So in Ohio, during the 2008 elections, Diebold voting machines dropped at least 1,000 votes in 9 county elections, and we're all here at least fairly familiar with that.
They were among the election voting machines that were dropped by the Secretary of State of California because they weren't up to snuff.
Right. Thank you.
In her words, 99.5% accurate, or in this case, much less, is not sufficient. It needs to be 100%.
Exactly. They initially blamed the problem on antivirus software, but eventually found that it was a problem with their own software.
Right. And what is if you have antivirus software on the voting machine, that means that Windows is on that machine. What is a full operating system doing on a voting machine?
Well, I'm not positive that they're saying that it was antivirus on the voting machines themselves and not on some sort of centralized database that handles the software. I'm not sure about that, but they did blame it on antivirus.
Same question I had for that.
Right. <It's>, maybe somebody will know. But they did, after that, notify 29 of other states with a workaround to this problem with their software. But what they didn't tell people at the time is that the same thing had happened in 2004 in Illinois, and that between those 4 years, nobody said anything or spread the word, and they were still using the same software with the same problems in 2008 in Ohio. Something similar happened in 2002 when 12,000 ballots were dropped by a Sequoia Systems voting machines in New Mexico, and this was long after the same problem previously happened in another state. And this is just two of many examples that are being included in a report from the Brennan Center for Justice. They're basically calling on Congress to provide authority for the Federal Election Assistance Commission, the EAC, to establish and maintain a publicly searchable database of known voting machine issues. Because the problem is it happens in a state, and the state says, no way, we're not going to use that bad software, or let's upgrade it. But then the information doesn't get spread out to other states, is what they're seeing as a repeating behavior.
Now, in fairness, just about every election has some irregularity so far in the United States, especially the major elections. So electronic voting isn't that much different in that regard. And I myself have actually used the electronic voting machines in Santa Cruz County when I vote.
Mm-hmm. I have
I figured I'm a geek, I would be able to have at least some context to what I'm doing and what dangers might be there. And I also wanted to evaluate it, and you know, one vote off
would be it. Eat our own dog food.
Yeah. And it was actually a fairly pleasant experience. I got out, my girlfriend and I went in to the polling place about the same time. She went into her voting booth the same time I went into my voting booth. We both had our stuff ready to go as to what we were going to vote.
You raced, didn't
and
you?
and I beat her. Like I got out much faster than she did. And at the end, there was a paper trail. There was a paper receipt that I got to see through the little window. It can be done correctly. So the fact that there are many voting machines that aren't done correctly is pretty damning.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't seem like that difficult a problem. I mean, when you think about what's required of a voting machine, you think about what we've done, you know, in when you think about credit card processing, of all the technology we have and all the crazy things we can do, okay, mm-hmm. You look at the very simple thing of voting, you know, you really, it's a whole binary kind of, you know, it seems like one of the simplest things to do, yet I wonder why there's so much chaos surrounding the whole idea.
It seems simple, but I can tell you because way back in the Wayback Machine, I worked for retail.
Way back in the Wayback Machine, that goes all the way back to 1996.
Yes.
In the old days, 1900s.
Way back in my Wayback Machine. Basically, I worked for a place that did retail installations of register equipment. And anytime you get to dealing with something that's kind of like a dumb terminal, you know, things that are run by centralized computers, and the hardware gets old, people that handle them aren't techies. They're just people that are given the equipment and say, here, go plug this in. And the companies that own the equipment, you know, the equipment gets old and they don't go out to all the locations and update the firmware on the equipment and different things like that. And things get old and dusty and thrown around and moved around and the cables get broken.
We had a caller come in and talk about all the random cables that are in back that you have to go back a long way to even recognize them if you were in the computer industry for that long. I'm talking RS-232 was brand new tech.
Yeah.
Compared to some of the stuff in the back of these point of sale machines.
Right. I mean, it's just insanity how archaic the hardware and the firmware on the hardware becomes after a few, you know, technology moves quickly. But those things bought by the taxpayers, they're getting reused because they can be expensive to replace all the time. But yeah, I mean, that's down a tangent. I'm just saying that could be one possibility of why these things happen.
Definitely. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
And Geek Speak on KUSP. KUSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support for businesses, tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specializes in protecting data and have been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio. With me in the air room are Al Luckow and Lindsay Lonnie. We're covering the news, and we're also taking calls. So if you want to call in to KUSP, the number is 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. And we can cover just about any question you have, at least as far as geeks are concerned, you know, Windows, Macs, Linux, or if you just want to try to stump us and hit us with a general science question, please call in with those two. Even if we don't know the answer and you do, then it is education and fun for the whole family.
Right. Thanks, Miles.
The whole family being us, of course. So let's see now. Who's up next? I think I might be next with a news story. And we were talking about security.
Mm-hmm.
I actually wanted to do a quick little follow-up on the voting machine story, which is just a little note for folks out there. Voting machines, something we've had problems with since they were first announced and first being used. So, I mean, it's been at least 10 years now that we've had them in major elections and had problems. And had issues with auditing and the like, and whether or not they're going to be open for the source code to be audited and have spot checks and the like. Just to have a point of reference, slot machines in Vegas must have their code auditable, have spot checks as people show up to make sure the systems haven't been tampered with, have a lot of that material. Now, we can do this with our slot machines, but we can't do this with our voting machines. Okay, my rant's over. Just had to put that out there.
Well, I want to put something a positive spin on the end of that, which is that California is one of the only states that recently passed a law requiring vendors to notify the Secretary of State and local election officials of any failure that's discovered within 30 days. So yay for California.
Yay for California. That's a positive note for us, not so positive for the rest of the country. But
although this bill, you know, or this document hopefully will push them to get the EAC to start doing this stuff. We'll see.
Hopefully. And let's see. How about we take some calls?
Dun, dun, dun. Dun, 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 dun.
First of all, I'm going to make sure that everyone can hear the call.
And you challenge them to try and stump us, so this should be good.
Nice going, Miles.
Hey, I'm okay with that. I'm up for the challenge. Are you not up for the challenge?
Dun, dun. Oh, it's on.
Line one, Michael from Santa Cruz. Hello, Michael. Are you on there?
He's a ghost.
Uh-oh. I think I have... Oh, wait. Let's try now, Michael.
Michael, where's the Michael?
No. Oh, no.
Just press every one of those buttons all at the same time.
Okay, well, let's try door number two. Anne in Santa Cruz.
Hello?
Hello, yes.
Uh-oh, I can't hear you.
She cannot hear. There we go. Can you hear me now? Oh, no, this is horrible. Okay.
The fun never stops. The geeks.
Ah, I see what I have done. Let's try that. Can you hear us now?
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Oh, goody, goody.
We could always hear you, actually.
Okay, I ran an ad on Facebook. It was very exciting. And now I have a bunch of data that they've given me, and I have no idea what it means. Have any of you done that, or would you, if I told you what the headings were, would you, could you venture a guess?
Give us the headings.
We love guessing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, they have impressions, which is in the thousands or tens of thousands. They have a social percent, which is in the 14 to 16% range. They have clicks. They have CTR percent. They have actions. They have AR percent. They have average CPC in dollars. Average CPM in dollars.
What's your ad for?
It's for the pottery and glass second sale. It actually turned out pretty well, I think, to do it on Facebook, but I'm not sure if the ad...
Did it link to an external site or a Facebook page? Or how
well,
exactly?
the ad itself can do either. You can link to your internal Facebook page, or you can link to a website.
But what did your ad do?
Mine linked to my internal Facebook page, and then I have my website there.
And so people click on this ad, and it takes them to your Facebook page that's for this pottery thing. And you can't purchase from the Facebook page.
No. It's an event. It happens twice a year. Mm-hmm. And so I thought it'd be nice to get the word out through friends and friends of friends.
Mm-hmm. Well, impressions is every time the page is loaded.
So impressions means every time they actually put my ad on the page.
But I don't know it's sort of like a hit. It's not really that.
Well, a hit is usually counted as a click-through. Someone actually...
Click-through is a click-through. I mean, you click on it, and then that's when... What you really care about is, you know, when people click on your ad and when they go there.
But here's the strange thing. Like, I have a week's worth of data, and everything says 8 clicks. I mean, that doesn't seem possible.
Well, 8 people clicked on your...
Yeah, but every single time, every single day... 8 people did it, only 8, no more, no less.
So it breaks it down by day, and it says every day there's been 8 clicks?
Yeah.
They've got a help tutorial thing, suggested best practices for advertising on Facebook.
Yeah, I've looked at some of that, and...
it's not very...
It's not really that intuitive.
No, it's not.
They probably want to keep it ambiguous, you know, just like their privacy policy.
Yeah, I'm wondering if they need like a dejargonator, you know, to tell you what the version of the words mean. Impressions, it seems, are clicks, but yeah, I don't know what all the other stuff is. Maybe we can do, you know, combing through and do a definition and give you a list afterwards or something like that. Put it up on the site.
Yeah, put a link to that. We'll put a link to that on the geekspeak.org site, the Facebook thing, and then anything else we find, we'll put there as well.
Yes. So thanks a lot for your call. Sorry that we couldn't be more of help, they're kind of confusing everyone here.
I think it would take someone who'd actually run an ad to look at that data and know what it's, I mean, you'd want to see it for yourself.
Yeah, someone dedicated to web marketing, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, well, it was a hope. Well, the interesting thing is that I offered a 5% discount for anybody who came to the October 3rd sale and said, you know, that they had to click like, they had to become a fan, mm-hmm. and then they would get the 5% discount. And I had, by the time of the sale, I had 203 fans. I don't know if they call them fans anymore. And I thought of that 203, some of them probably got there through the ad, or I had hoped.
Yeah, something more than eight anyway.
And you know? Not one person asked for the discount. Not one out of 203. Now, all those 203, I couldn't tell. That mm-hmm. was what I was trying to figure out. Who came because of the ad?
Right. So you really don't know.
That didn't help.
Yeah.
Right.
So in a way, you feel like the ad worked for you, but then another way, you don't really know what the ad did.
In a way, I feel like the ad didn't work.
Ooh, I think
somebody would have said, hey, you know, I got offered 5% if I clicked. And yeah, I did. Where's my 5%? I mean, it seems like somebody would.
Yeah, we'll put our information up. Yeah, we'll put the information up on the website. If you have any more info, please send us an email. Go to the website and type contact us. We'd love to hear a follow-up on that and get more information.
I think I found a page that has some terminology for it, so I'll put that up there.
Wonderful.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye. And Michael is back.
Hello, I'm here.
Hello.
Hi. So I'm calling about my mother's notebook that died a few weeks ago. I mean, I tried fixing it, and I wanted to get your impression if I can do something more about fixing it, because I wasn't able to do that. So it's a Toshiba laptop running Windows Vista.
And so a recent laptop?
What?
Is it a recent laptop?
It's probably 2 years old.
Okay.
You know? And so someone went over to her house, some tech guy went over to her house and said, oh, I think your hard drive died. So I took the notebook home and bought a hard drive. And it was a Seagate FDE drive, full disk encryption drive. And that's supposed to be some security drive. Mm-hmm. And so these are the things that I did. First thing I did was I tried to install the hard drive and see if the notebook would boot up from that. I also did the recovery disk because there's power to the CD-ROM DVD drive. And I put the recovery disk in there and see if it would boot up from that. I tried to boot up without the battery. And I changed the memory DIMMs or SIMs, whatever they're called. And I actually reversed them, put one in, tried to boot up with just one, and, you know, did a whole bunch of things with the memory.
But it wasn't booting up even with just booting off of a CD?
Yeah, it wasn't booting up.
Okay, yeah, that's not a hard drive problem.
Interesting.
Yeah, the one question that I had was this Seagate drive with this FDE encryption, it's full disk encryption. They said that there may be an issue with the BIOS being able to talk to the hard drive, and I was wondering if you guys ever heard anything about that or know.
Were you getting any response? Like, was it going to the BIOS screen?
Well, no, I get nothing. And what happens is when I hit the power button, I hear a little sound that sounds like the hard drive is trying to do something. There's this just for a second or two. Just this little sound and then nothing. And if I have a CD-ROM in there, it actually tries to power up from the CD-ROM. I mean, if I have a CD in there, a recovery disk in there, it tries to power up, but there's nothing. So I'm wondering if it's just something going on with the motherboard and there's a chip wrong or
it makes me think of two things, two possibilities. One is that the motherboard has died, but there's still power going to the peripherals, which is why your hard drive and the CD-ROM drive would be mm-hmm. spinning up. Although usually if the motherboard is completely dead, it doesn't send that startup signal.
Right.
The other is that the screen is bad. so that things are happening, but you're not able to see it. Well, that's another distinct possibility.
Now, would that hard drive make more noise, though, if the screen, if it was actually trying, if it was booting up? I mean,
yes, you would start hearing it start to churn.
But there's nothing. Yeah. There's nothing on the hard drive, though, because it's a new hard drive.
Right, but
so
you would be hearing
from the
CD-ROM drive.
I put the old one back in.
Oh, you did. Oh, it's the old one. All right,
and you would be hearing something from the CD-ROM drive. You'd hear it seeking. So if you're not hearing those noises after the fact, then it's not a screen. It is probably the motherboard.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks.
Our condolences.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks. Okay.
All right. Bye. Take care. Best of luck.
Thanks. Bye.
Okay, let's see. What time is it? Oh, we have plenty of time. Once again, if you want to call into the show, the numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free in the U.S. or in California. I forget which. I believe it's in California. 1-800-655-5877. And we will try Rich. Rich in Monterey. Hello.
Hello.
Hello, you're on GeekSpeak.
Well, thank you. Great show. Thanks for keeping it going.
Thank you. So you have a Dell computer you're having problems with?
I have a Dell XPS, and it runs Vista. And my virus software wouldn't load, so I went to the tech on them. And I went to the second level of tech with the virus software people, and they finally said, well, your Windows is corrupt. You need to reinstall it. So at this point, and Dell did not ship with a Vista disk.
And they've got all their own customized software, too. Dell is like...
Yeah, but they should have a recovery partition, shouldn't they?
I would think, but, you know, it's like those Dells, you know... You almost can't even install regular software on them. They need their own like version of Windows,
right? And that's what I think. Like they have there should be a rescue partition on that drive unless you've cleared it out.
I was wondering whether it would be more to my advantage then instead of reinstalling Vista to move up to Windows 7.
If you're willing to spend the money, I don't think it's a bad choice. The general consensus has been Windows 7 is a better choice.
How old's the machine?
I got it in beginning of 98.
Beginning of 98?
Well, I got the first day Vista came out. I was hoping to get XP.
2008, right?
Oh, not 2008.
2008, yes.
I was going to say.
Yeah. It unfortunately was supposed to come with XP, but because it shipped the first day of Vista, I got this.
Windows 7 in general, I don't know. It doesn't really matter. Actually, how old the system is, it seems to me that Windows 7 runs faster than Vista does. Vista was always
If you had a choice between Vista and 7, choose 7. If Vista ever ran on it, you can run 7 on it, and you certainly don't want to be running Vista.
Yeah.
You know.
Windows 7
well,
is much faster.
Well, I mean, if Vista was working for him, then he can still use it. Yeah. And Windows 7 does cost money, so it's a question of whether or not you want to spend that money.
Maybe the first thing you can try, and I've had to do this with Dell machines at our office, is contacting them, and they'll say they shipped a disk with the computer, even if sometimes you can't find it. But they will try to charge you $20 to send you a new one, which is a rebuild disk that contains the drivers for the machine and all that kind of stuff. So it might be worth a try instead of paying for a new machine if you want to deal with Vista from here out. But Windows 7 seems a lot better in my opinion anyway.
Right.
Okay, if I went Windows 7, is there anything I need to watch out for installing it?
I'm not sure about upgrading. I've only dealt with it on a clean install. So
right. Okay. First off, the question we always ask folks: do you have a backup?
It's right.
It is backed up.
Okay, then it shouldn't matter so much. You know,
it's just getting used to the navigation a little bit, but it is intuitive. The navigation styles, and I'm pretty sure they have a setting where you can set it to XP style navigation if that's more familiar. But it'd be worth it to get familiar with the new style of navigation.
Yeah. And then you'll be able to use IE9 when it comes out.
Right.
Although I think it might be compatible with Vista as well, isn't it? Or is it just Windows 7?
I'm not sure.
Oh, I think it is Windows 7. I just ran across the story, the new Explorer.
Okay.
They're just focusing on the new stuff.
Okay.
You know.
Of course, if you're running Firefox, like we always recommend on the show, or Chrome, then it's a moot point. But so it's a question of how light you want your wallet to be.
Okay.
Either way will probably work out all right. I mean, your system has already run Vista, so Vista should be a good sell. You just have to get that disk again from Dell.
Mm-hmm.
If there is no recovery partition.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for your call.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, tech calls, like people having computer problems. It seems like it's been a while.
Yeah.
It seems like usually they're these obscure software problems and not the bread and butter.
Well, maybe Mercury's in retrograde or something.
Machines are rebelling.
Yeah.
Could be.
So let's give a shot to Marty in Santa Cruz, who has a comment about voting machines.
Hi.
Hello, Marty.
Yeah, I have a comment about the voting machines thing and also a question, but I think it's kind of hopeless, the question. I think that it's possible, like you guys were saying, that you could do a legitimate voting machine apparatus. But I think the problem is the integrity of the people involved, it's like they kind of keep the window of cheating open with, proprietary information type things. And I think the best example for me goes back to the 2000 election when, Diebold, was the famous one with a lot of the voting machines. But they were also doing work for Jeb Bush and Katherine Harris in Florida, supposedly trying to eliminate the, ineligible ex-felon voters, from the rolls. But they set up this system, and Diebold, to give them a little credit, actually told Bush and Harris that they weren't, setting up the equation such that it would get, like, they put in, and they were specifically targeting, like, black people.
Yeah,
they
we've heard all sorts of things with regard to Diebold. We know that, like, there's been some shady deals with regard to that. Thanks for that comment.
But this was not even Diebold's fault in particular. They told Katherine Harris and Jeb Bush that unless you put in, like, the person's social security number and address and stuff like that as part of the targeting thing, that each name would hit, 5 or 10 different people, right, and throw them off the list when you know that there was only one felon. And they said, that's fine.
Yeah, and then, once again, but that's not necessarily a voting machine thing. That's more the felon voter rolls. That was a big scandal back then. You had I'm sorry to cut you off with regard to this. It's a very interesting topic. Unfortunately, it's geek speak, so we want to keep things a little bit more technical rather than strictly political.
Right.
A very interesting conversation, though. But you also had a printing problem with a PowerBook.
Yeah. Well, I have a PowerBook. It's a 180C. I think it was the first color, and it's, I think...
Oh, man, you're really going way back.
Yeah. But it's working. I think it's working.
Except for printing.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah, unfortunately, when communicating with the printer that I have, which is like a laser printer, kind of a big office one that I got from Dave's computer, used, it's worked up until last night. And then now when I say print, it does all the things leading up to a print. And the only thing that I notice that doesn't come on screen is like the where it says spooling or something, right?
You're running OS 9 or OS 7 or OS 8 or what?
No, it's just a Macintosh.
Right, but the system that you're running is not OS 10 on that PowerBook.
Is it like System 7, System 8?
Probably, if you're lucky, probably System 7?
I don't even know what that is.
That has a lot to do with how the machine deals with printers.
Mm-hmm.
And usually it's a matter of choosing the printer. Thinking back to that old system, is it the chooser?
I wish John Tracy were here.
I know the guy that was the project manager for that PowerBook.
Oh, really?
Actually, yeah, at Apple. But to get him on the phone in a second would be tough. But choosing the printer, you have to select it, and somehow it got unselected.
Maybe, actually that's one thing I didn't do was the chooser.
Yeah, try that.
And it didn't tell me, though. Usually, I figure it would say, can't find the printer, and it never did that.
Do a search for printer utility or something like that, because there's a thing in OS 9 or all the way going back to OS 8, I believe, that allows you to choose the printer, and that sounds like what's happening. Everything's going right, but it's just not. You didn't choose it. It just somehow got deselected, or something happened, But I've been in that.
And it did. I did find in the trash. It said rescued from my hard drive, in like a tiny file about spooling.
Well, that doesn't probably matter, but
that doesn't matter. Okay.
Yeah, but try
I didn't know if I need to move that somewhere.
It's just something that didn't go and it just ended up getting trashed.
Oh,
but yeah, you got to do a search for printer utility. I think that's what it's called.
Okay,
it's a long time ago, but I've been in that spot, and you'll find a way out of it.
All right, thank you, and I hope all our votes get counted.
Yeah,
thank you for your call.
All right, bye.
All right, bye. Okay, let's see here. Oh, we have what is logged here as a plea for help. Rich in SoCal.
Hi. I don't know whether this... I'm trying to turn this out of a whining session here. So Google Calendar Viewer is a Google gadget or widget, whatever you call it, on my Google homepage that I've used for years to keep track of upcoming things.
Right, the My Google page, yeah.
Right. So simultaneous with Google's stock going up 11% last week, the calendar viewer just disappeared. I mean, it's dead. It just gives an error message, and I've been going through, you know, the forums and stuff about it, and there's like 58,000 of us who were using it, and it's gone, and you can't get hold of anybody, and Google won't respond. And I wonder if you have any ideas what to do.
I don't know what happened. We don't have anyone, any contacts in Google that I'm aware of, but at the same time, it seems to me there are many different calendar widgets out there, many of them that would be able to talk to Google Calendar.
And I also, I would try re-adding it, because normally on that page, on that home page, you can add all sorts of plugins and widgets. And you can just click add and search a database of stuff, or you can plug
in
a URL.
You can still find, I mean, it's one of the earlier ones, and it's pretty popular, and I've tried that. You can still get to the place, and the only thing that's there is a list of a whole bunch of people saying what happened, I've lost all my, you know, upcoming meetings. Because the other problem with it that always made me nervous, there was no way to make a copy of all your stuff that you'd entered into it.
If it is the calendar widget that I'm thinking of, all of your data should be saved in your Google Calendar. So you should still be able to get access to it. Are you on Windows or a PC?
Windows.
I mean, on Mac, sorry. Windows or a PC, that's kind of redundant. Let's see, trying to think of what...
What I'm guessing happened is that it was an older model of the calendar and that they've created a newer calendar interface.
Yeah, an API break, yeah.
And that people using the older one, you know, are just going to have to get used to the look and feel of the newer one.
To get to your information, you can go to google.com/calendar.
Okay.
And you should be able to see all of the existing information that's there. I can't recall. Lindsay, do you know of a good calendaring app for Windows that hooks up with CalDev?
I'm not sure because I use Google Calendar too. So
right, because there is the ability, like, to connect it up with, for example, Exchange, I believe.
Right. So I've got calendars, access to calendars in Outlook and a bunch of places. Just this one was so convenient because it was like,
right,
you know, a little small thing. And
if I were you, I would go to look up all the various widgets instead of looking for the one that you already had. Look for all of the other variants, because there are several of them that all connect up to Google Calendar.
That's a good idea. That's a good idea. Great.
All right.
Thank you
for your call.
Hey, you know, I did find the answer to that. You do have to go to Desktop Printer Utility for that last caller.
Okay.
And you know, it's in the application folder in Utilities, and then make a new desktop printer. I posted a link to it on geekspeak.org. It'll be out live after the show. You know, it should be relatively simple.
Oh, wonderful.
Add a printer.
Thank you all. And let me get through some general housekeeping here. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. And Al, do you have a USB of the week for us?
Yes, I do. This is just completely... Well, you know what absinthe is?
Yes, the alcohol.
Yes, it's like a potent green liqueur, and you know, artists drink it in Paris, and you know, it's all, you know, has wormwood in it, you know. Anyway, the way you drink absinthe is you put a sugar cube on a spoon, a little spoon, and then the spoon has all these little vents in it. So you pour cold water over the sugar cube, and then mm-hmm. it runs through the sugar cube, and then through the vents in the spoon, and then into your actual absinthe, which is like...
It becomes actually relatively palatable.
Yeah, then you can actually drink it. It's really strong, like kind of... Is it licorice, or... I guess mm-hmm. it's kind of like I've had some, you know, I got a bottle of it once when it sort of became legal in this country. Anyhow, somebody has developed a USB absinthe spoon, and it's really weird because you don't heat the the sugar or the water. Actually, you cool it. So it's one of those things where this has absolutely no reason to exist. it's a spoon with a USB dongle on the other end, and I've looked all over the place, and I can't figure out why they did that. It's like putting a USB port on an eraser or something.
It's so that you can use the disk drive as your cup holder, and then put the spoon in the USB drive and make your drink right there.
Oh, that's a good idea. Computer. Yeah, that would make sense. Lindsay, you found a reason for this thing to exist. I just thought it was the world's dumbest USB gadget. Anyhow, there you go. It's real, and we'll have a link to it on geekspeak.org.
Thank you. Al, thank you for that. Geekspeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence, and we thank the Puppet Master for its use. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, and we're streaming and podcasting at KUSP.org. And thank you, Al Luckow and Lindsay Lonnie. This is Miles Elam hosting.